Hi.
Hello.
I'm Alexis Hyde.
I'm Erica Wong.
This is Hyde or Practice. This week, y'all, are you excited? I know you are because you saw the title when you clicked on this and you were like, holy moly. I almost said something really profane, but I like to hold off on swearing until the second half. We've got Carly Packer, the principal owner of the eponymous Carly Packer Gallery here in Los Angeles, who is just incredible. If you're not familiar with her program, the link will be in the description notes for you guys to check out and enjoy. She's in the middle of installing her next show, so she is deeply generous to give us this time. Carly, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So do you mind, for our listeners who aren't familiar, do you mind just kind of giving a little bit of a broader intro of who you are, what you do, where you do it?
Yeah, of course. So it's actually the year anniversary of the gallery, which sounds crazy because I've been dealing for the last 6 years. My first gallery was called Club Pro Los Angeles, and it was based downtown on 15th and Main, I think. Yeah. And we did a lot of emerging artists, mostly from LA, who are now doing really well. You know, I showed like Lauren Halsey, Mario Ayala, Alake Schilling, Geneva Ellis. So it was sort of a primary location for people to jumpstart their careers. And it was a very like exciting, good time. And it was actually only 2 years long, even though it feels like it was a million years long. And so after Club Pro, was doing advising and sort of some itinerant programming, still working with a lot of the same artists, just in different ways. And then after COVID, I started looking for a space again because it was time for me to open up shop fully. And so, yeah, it's been almost a year now. And it's a similar sort of model, which is mostly emerging artists in LA. The next show that I have is a London-based artist, actually, and it's her first solo presentation in the U.S., opening Saturday. I tend to sort of give a lot of, first projects to people is sort of, I guess, my MO, whether I try for it to be or not.
It is. It's what you do. Yeah. And you're very good at it. Actually, that brings me to kind of like my first question. I would love to know, how do you find artists? Because you do show a lot of people very early on, first shows. And like, how have you found artists over the years?
I mean, it's really different every time. You know, sometimes it's through, you know, a few different people suggesting them, or this one woman that I'm going to work with I was just at a party talking with her and really liked her. And we were just chatting about random stuff. And then she, you know, an hour into our conversation told me she was an artist and I liked her work a lot, which is really rare. I don't like a lot of art. So sometimes it's through recommendations. Sometimes it is through, you know, someone that I knew years ago, and now that I see that they're kind of making better work. I'm not much of an Instagram person at all. I tend to like paintings that are that look a lot different in person than they do in images. So I don't really like looking at paintings online, which is a weird thing in this day and age, actually. And also, if I see something that I think looks really good in an image, I'm really I don't trust it at all. And they tend to look really different in person than they do in photos.
Yeah. Fair enough. I think that's true.
And I think that that's like a hard part about the post-COVID economy. Is how much, you know, people buy based off of images. And then, but it's like a photo-based economy. So a lot of these young artists actually, you know, they make an image in Photoshop or something, and then they project it onto a canvas, and then they photograph it. And so it's almost like the painting doesn't even matter anymore. It's just like the photo of the photo and then the photo is actually the end result of it.
Yeah.
Which I always thought was really interesting.
I was going to say, you've been doing this for a while, and like, people forget like how much this Instagram social media sharing of art is like pretty new in like the grand scheme of things, that like everyone's like, oh, you have to have, you know, your Instagram presence. And it's like, that's new of like the last like 5 years, really.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
Before, you know, maybe 7 for some like really progressive younger people. But,
and I do look at, you know, if someone suggests an artist, I do, the first thing I do is look at their Instagram. You know, so it is sort of like a double-edged sword, because you kind of have to. I don't look at people's websites, you know, I look at their Instagram.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting, because I think there's a split between the people who are like, I want people to look at my website. And then there are the people who are like, I want you to look at my Instagram. And then people sort of get really confused. It's like, what should I be updating? Where are people actually going to find me? Should I have a website? Can I have Instagram to go and, oh, like, instead of having a website, like, what am I supposed to be doing here? What's the best representation of me if I want to be taken seriously, represented, et cetera?
Yeah, and theoretically, you know, an artist doesn't need anything besides a gallery who's sort of having all of their images online for them, theoretically. But of course, if you're not represented by someone, then it's a different story. But yeah, I think it is a weird thing that artists do have to do, which is, you know, spend more time hustling themselves and sort of thinking about how they appear to, you know, a faceless audience, instead of thinking about just what their work looks like and what they want their work to be.
Fair.
So I think it does a lot of negative, has a larger standing negative impact actually on how art is made than we kind of think about it. Because it's negative. I mean, it's like, if someone's constantly, you know, these people aren't models. They're not supposed to be models. You know, they're supposed to be a painter or an artist, you know, but when you have to be concerned with your image, you know, to the outside world so consciously, then a lot of people forget that being an artist isn't about being famous necessarily. It's about making art.
Yeah. Not being an influencer, not being a brand, not being, you know, perfectly curated coffee mornings and dog stuff or whatever you want to have. And it is totally, if you're updating your website, you're updating your Instagram, you're updating, you know, your portfolios, it does add up. What, on that note, what is the most helpful thing that you see that artists do that help you get an idea of what kind of artists that they are, to kind of like the point?
I mean, Instagram.
You are such a monster. I love it. You're like, I hate fighting art on Instagram, but I'm looking at your Instagram and it better be good.
It's true. And it's the problem with it is that, because I don't even really remember, I think, you know, in Club Pro days, you know, which was what we started in 2016, you know, Instagram was still a thing. It just wasn't as big of one.
By the way, I didn't know that was you.
Yeah.
I love that. It makes sense now that you're saying it. It's like a bunch of like puzzle pieces just like fit together. And I'm like, my gosh, of course that was Carla.
Really cool, because we didn't, you know, we had half of the gallery was studios, right? So the studios did cover the overhead. We had a really low overhead. So we were able to do so many, you know, interesting projects. Like there was that one that was, you know, Rafa Esparza and Timo Fowler collaborative, like massive installation. And, you know, for a gallery that had been around for 6 months, sort of doing a project of that scale and magnitude was really impactful, I think, for also a generation of LA artists working at that time. Because when, you know, there were younger spaces, sort of, you know, it was like us and BBQLA pretty much. And we were selling work too. So it was like the idea that you could kind of have this, you know, it wasn't an artist run closet, you know, it was a 3,000 square foot space. So it was, I think there on the imagination of Los Angeles artists at the time, Club Pro had a huge impact. I don't remember what you were saying before, though, what the question was before.
Doesn't matter. We're moving on. We're going forward. What was the impetus of like, oh, you know what? I can do something that's not standard.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've never been a rule follower ever. I never believed in like following proper steps in order to get somewhere. I mean, the first like 5 art fairs I did, I never paid for them. And I don't even know how I finagled that, you know, but I sort of, I just believe in skipping steps really strongly. I like, you know,
I love that.
But so, you know, not having a gallery, but still sort of working with artists, the question was, how could I still, you know, sell their work or help them, you know, get somewhere else or honestly make money, you know? So even before I had Club Pro, I did some, you know, random curation of things. And so it felt natural to sort of be like, okay, you know, I need a location and I need the artist. So I did a few house shows, which I always love doing because I think viewing art in a domestic space is really worthwhile. And also it's nice because you get to walk in and sit on a couch. And I love sitting down. I hate standing up. So it's just like, you know, I hate when I walk into a gallery and there's nowhere for me to just sit down. I don't like having conversations standing up. I like being sitting down. So I think it's nice when you're in a house because there are like all these areas that you can kind of relax in. So I found that people would stay a lot longer too. Someone would come and they wouldn't just pop in and pop out. They'd be there for like an hour, you know, so it was much more kind of a classic like salon style of experiencing art because people would come and be a destination. They would hang out. They would actually talk about stuff. And I liked doing that a lot. Most of the money that I was making at the time was from advising. You know, if your expenses are really low and you make 10%, you really just have to sell like 2 paintings a month, you know, in order to break even or in order to pay, you know, your house rent. But at a certain point in time, if I realized that if I wanted to keep growing and, you know, feed my ambition, that the next step was having a gallery again. Because when you're advising, you're a little bit distant from like the actual culture of things because you're not producing anything and you're not, you know, of course there are advisors who like make the careers of certain artists, but it's not as easy to do that continuously as it is when you have a gallery.
Mm-hmm.
So it just sort of felt like the inevitable step of making more money and having more of an impact with artists. Let's open a space again.
It's fun to have people come to you as opposed to having to go to people.
Different experience though, I would imagine. Both worthwhile, I think, if it's a good studio visit.
Yeah, and I still do a lot of advising stuff now. But I think that actually having the gallery has increased the amount of advising that I can do for people as well.
So I'm curious, if you're looking at people's Instagrams, what qualifies as a good Instagram account that would make you very simply want to query it a little bit more? It's not like, oh, I think that there's this assumption that if there's some magical profile that's you're going to see it instantly. You're just be like, I'm going to sign you. I don't think that's actually how it works. You would at least want to just ask a few more questions.
Yeah. I mean, I do like when people aren't just only posting their work. I also like hate gallery accounts. They're so boring, you know? So it's like, I think it's nice to sort of see how someone lives because I'm a very sensitive and engaged person. So I have to work with people that I want to make money for, you know? And so there's something about, you know, having a personality, showing things that you know, random shit, apophenic stuff, you know, things that don't necessarily have to do with your art, you know? And then sort of, I think it's like it is a personality thing, you know? I mean, I never, until I meet someone in person, you know, I don't spend tons of time on anyone's page ever really. And I do work with a lot of artists or two that don't have Instagrams at all. But I think that, you know, if I sort of a quote unquote dream artist profile would be someone who's just kind of like wild and out in their own way and doing whatever the fuck they want, you know, and maybe post like a corner picture of a painting, maybe post the full thing, maybe post them, you know, not like nothing stylized, just something that feels like natural. and true to them.
I feel at this point we're all so like social media, like adept at like being able to tell too when someone's being natural or someone's trying too hard or kind of like, oh, this falls flat and I don't feel you. I feel like it's just not, doesn't feel honest. It's nice to feel honesty.
Yeah, it is very transparent. And, you know, I personally like artists that want a dealer too, because there are a lot of artists that want to, you know, they want to manage their own everything. They want to, you know, they want to show with tons of different people, and that's cool. Don't get me wrong. It's just not for me, because when you're working with someone, it's such an intimate relationship. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like I have half these people's like social security number memorized. You know, and like have images of their passports, you know, when I'm booking them flights. So it's such an intimate relationship that is so special. And, you know, it's like, I'm a therapist, I'm a mother, like I'm a girlfriend, you know, I'm a friend, I'm the business person, I'm the advice on paintings, I'm the advice on, you know, life stuff. And so when you're starting to work with someone, it's so important that you like actually care about them as a person. So sometimes even too, like I've worked with artists where I'm not even sure if I like their art at all, but I just think that them as a person, like in the world, as an artist in the world, feels important. You know, and it feels like the sort of way that they're living, the ideas that they have, the dreams and like aspirations and ideas that they have are much more important to a general culture of art making that I'm interested in, you know, pumping that up. So I have worked with people in that way before, for sure, where I'm just like, you feel important for art.
Yeah, I think that people don't talk enough about like how intimate that relationship can be of like gallerist, dealer, artist, where it's not just like, you know, it's so easy. And I default to it too, but it's usually because I'm trying to defend why galleries, dealers, advisors have to take a percentage because we need to get paid also. Yeah. But I think that like, it's not just, okay, like here's cash for goods. You know, there's so much around it. So much of that soft touch, you know, person to person, interpersonal like situations where it's a lot of support emotionally. And financially.
Definitely. And also, you know, it's like every single relationship that I build in my life, every person I meet is potentially a beneficial person for them as well. So every person I meet is someone who could be a client for one of my artists, you know? And I mean, I used to work with someone that I swear for a few months, I was just on the phone with him all day long. He would be painting, listening to music, and I would be doing my shit. But it was just like there was some sort of like he was trying to work through some stuff. And for some reason, just having me on the phone, you know, and, you know, every couple like, you know, 30 minutes, he'd be like, are you still there? And I'd be like, yep, still here, you know. And it was a funny thing, and I didn't mind at all. And in a way, it actually helped me work as well. But I find when people, you know, yeah, there's a lot of not defense, but I had a family friend be like, I don't understand why, you know, the gallery takes 50%. It seems like they're stealing from them. And I'm like, well, I fucking have 10K minimum, usually 25K expenses a goddamn month to be out in the world meeting people to help sell that person's art down the line. So it's not, and like, I'm on the phone with them every day.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, and I pay for their materials.
That's very generous.
You know,
so like,
what I wish that when we were in art school, that there was somebody who actually sort of listed out that this would be this relationship.
I always think,
because like, I've never heard this. And it just like, I feel like inside of me, I'm just sitting here thinking that would have been so nice if somebody actually had said to you that this could be a relationship that you would have with your dealer. Or this could be what it looks like if you find gallery representation, because it's never really talked about. So then you're just assuming what it could look like. And then you're operating based on they're going to take 50% from you. And so I think like on that basis, it's a me against them thing. Cause you're stealing money from me. Like, I've made all this work, blah, blah, blah. And then it's like, you're going to take half of it from me. How dare you? Mm-hmm. But like, no one's ever really said, by the way, it would be this really nurturing relationship where I would come in and I would basically shelter you from all the things that whatever. And then you would just sit there and make work and you're like, oh, wonderful. So it's sort of like going back to art school and like wherever, like I'm just in this like box and I could just do things and I don't have to think about other things. And it's never like, I've never heard people talk about it in like this capacity where it could be this very nurturing relationship and just harnessing the skill that you have and just like letting you do your own thing, which is really nice.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, once again, this is how I do things. I don't think it's how necessarily other people do things, but also it's not necessarily what other people want either. You know, some artists want to have total autonomy over where things go, you know, where they go next. You know, some people don't want, it's like the same thing with romantic relationships. You know, some people just want a date. They're not looking for a committed relationship, you know?
Some people need to be texting 100 times a day. Some people want one text a day. And both of those are fine, but knowing who you are and what you want is really helpful to get further in a relationship.
Mm-hmm. So as a dealer for me, I work my best when I'm in committed, you know, relationships with people, not when, you know, because if I'm going to do all this work to build someone up to a certain point, and then they're just going to like show with someone who's exactly, you know, my level, it, you know, then it doesn't make any sense to me. I also feel like as a young gallery, you know, everyone is like, oh, you know, these bigger galleries taking, you know, younger artists and stuff. For me, that's a goal, you know. Like, I can't imagine being bummed if an artist I work with gets picked up by a bigger gallery. A, because I learned my lesson and I buy work from them in the beginning. But B, because that is what you, if you really believe in someone, that's what you want for them. And if you have a solid relationship with them, then theoretically you still benefit over time from it. You know, whether you do own their work or whether you're still somehow a part of the machine with them.
I agree. I think that's also interesting too, is I think that like it goes on not just like the artist side, but like if anybody is like listening that like is interested in working at a gallery, I definitely didn't know when I first got into, you know, working at galleries, how quickly it was going to be all of the things that you were talking about and, you know, on the phone support and ordering food and helping with materials. It's a lot. But again, then there's some galleries where it's not any of that. And it is just like a store that you just like come in and buy. But again, it is like the whole scale of all of it.
Yeah. We're just like editing CDs.
Yeah, exactly.
A little bit.
Oh my God.
Which is, you know, part of the sort of not struggle, but, you know, situation that I've been in recently is I use a lot of banal admin stuff that is obviously necessary to do, but as a procrastination from things that I actually have to get done. And so I'm trying to figure out even how to like delegate things out that are the things that I find really relaxing to do at 9 p.m. on a Tuesday, you know, but it's a form of procrastination. That's for sure.
But
yeah.
How do you make that jump to start like the delegation with like your support staff?
I mean, I have, you know, the woman who was interning for me, I brought on part time, and there's another woman that I have freelancing for me that does more of like archive stuff. And so that's just been in the last like 2 months that I've had both of them. And it is really helpful. Yeah, it is very helpful. And I like working with other people too. You know, it's like, if it's just me, I get lonely, you know?
Yeah, I definitely do.
It's nice having other, so I think wanting to have other people around, you know, I mean, I'm on the phone nonstop, it feels like all day long, but I also love being on the phone. I'm a phone call girl. I love when people call me. People are like, why do you always call? Why don't you text like a normal person? I'm like, because my hand hurts. My hands, this phone is heavy. I'm already on it all day long or typing all day long. My fucking hand hurts.
Fair. These are like very fair things.
Yeah, or I send voice notes.
I'm a voice note person.
They make me laugh too.
Voice notes. Just really good for people to get like my uninterrupted train of thought for three consecutive, like 3 minute bursts.
Yeah. Sometimes I have friends who send them to me and they're like, what do you think? And I'm like, I did not listen. That was crazy. Like, what the hell? I'm like, what? I don't know. I don't have 3 minutes right now. Sorry.
I accidentally deleted it. Sorry. That's fine. But I feel like also the etiquette of that is like sometimes that happens and it's like fine because the other person most likely just needed to get it off their chest.
Usually that's how I feel
about that.
Usually.
Again.
But kind of going back to also like in art school, I mean, and not having anyone sort of talk that much about the dealer relationship, you know, there's also the problem in art school where there's no like business related conversations too. So you either breed a bunch of artists who are like anti-market for no reason besides they like read something of the Frankfurt School, or like, you know, people who don't even have any understanding of how the market works at all. And it's really a disservice to artists, you know, to not have a business orientated class or, you know, knowledge of things, or to only be taught by like professors who are anti-market, you know. And I always find that someone being anti-market is such a point of privilege too, you know, because most of the time they are not even paying. It turns out they're not the ones paying for school anyways. So yeah, I do think that there is a lack in art schools about actually educating people.
It is. And I think that's also like, not only is it a point of privilege, but it's also like, it like reinforces the architecture of the privilege, because the only people who are coming out of art school with like business acumen are people who went into art school with business acumen, because like their parents or their families are in some sort of business or art related. And so like, they have no problem navigating the market at 22.
And you know, I don't have, you know, I think in any situation in life, your greatest strength is your greatest weakness. Mm-hmm. You know, your greatest privilege is a huge issue as well. And I think, you know, I don't come from an art family. I don't come from an art collecting family. My dad calls paintings pictures. It's really cute. He's like, I really like this picture, Carly. I'm like, good, me too. You know, but so I always thought, you know, it was a disservice that I didn't. And, you know, at the same point, it is a disservice, but it's also a strong point too. Sometimes it's harder to feel that way, but it is, you know, like the eye of an outsider versus a trained eye is always really different.
I think so. And I think it's probably also like has been lended you a lot of like your outside thinking of like skipping steps. Like, why can't you just do this? Whereas somebody on like an inside track would be like, oh no, I have to absolutely take these steps before I can do that. And you're kind of like, why not?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I wonder, I know for a fact why art schools don't teach business. It's because there's no enrollment. Students aren't interested in taking the classes because they're not sexy. So if there's no enrollment, they cannot open the class because no one's going to take it. And they cannot make it a mandatory core class because it's too low. Like, it's a different mentality when students are forced to go and take core rather than elective.
Are you saying that art market gallery administrative classes aren't sexy to 18-year-olds, Erica? Is that what you're telling me?
I'm saying that they would rather sit in their studio and whatever it is that they
do. Literally anything else.
In the studio and like do whatever. But
literally anything else. And me being like, so this is why you need to prepare for your taxes annually.
Yes, I understand that, but like, but that's the problem. And so because enrollment is very low, so no one is taking the class. And so those classes aren't pushed on to students until the very, very, very end of the degree, which then people get really panicked. And there's a part of me that wonder, you, to our listeners, whether actually there is something there to go and be said. Maybe like if you're in art school, take the business class.
Even if it's
like super not sexy, just take the class.
And take the business class while you have access to it.
Take it. Yeah, just don't worry about it. It's going to be okay.
Maybe I'll start a lecture series called Making Business Sexy Again.
If anybody can, it's you. Absolutely.
Yeah, and I'll present it to once a month to various art schools.
Yes.
Lecture series. I would love that. I love talking to art students. It's one of my favorite things. There was only one person, Josh Callahan. He brought his art students, Otis maybe, to the gallery one time, and I had the best time. Because for me, I was like, do whatever the fuck you want to do. Like, don't feel the pressure of having to do a certain thing. You know, there are people I know, you know, Henry Taylor is a great example, you know, of not really exhibiting until he was 40. You know, some people do things really young, some people do things really late, but every single thing that you do in your life influences how you make art, and you never know how it will, so you just have to live the best life possible.
That'd be true yourself.
That was basically the conclusion of my last visit.
I love that, dude. I bet those little Otis students were just vibrating when they came out, being like, I've got permission to do what I want.
Next time I lecture in my professional practice, I'm gonna be like, hi, can you come and like lecture and just let them know? Because they're always shocked when that's not true. You don't have to do this much work. And I'm like, you do. You do have to do
work. And I think a lot of people think that being an artist is just that, being an artist, and like forget that you have to make work. Like, so many people want to be a quote unquote artist, but don't want to actually work.
Yes. God, that's the truth.
I don't really know them and I don't really spend time with them, but I heard they're out there.
You're not going to find any of them at Carly Packer, but
yeah.
They exist.
Don't know them.
They do exist. Yeah. I can assure you.
Yeah.
On that note, Carly, I'm going to ask you, what have you been reading, watching, or listening to this week?
Okay, I've been reading actually that Steve Martin book. What's it called? An Object of Beauty? Is that what it's called?
Oh, yeah, that's good.
Yeah, a friend of mine, she was like, I was telling her this story, and she's like, you remind me of the main character in this book. You should read it. And honestly, I haven't read for like, I was a big, big nerd growing up. We weren't allowed to watch TV. I was like a big nerd in college. I was dating like a literature professor right after school. Like, I used to read so much. Now I don't know how to. I just don't even know how to read. But this is the first book I've like read for years. I actually also have been reading again Barry Hannah, who is like a short story writer from the South. And I've been listening to probably the only podcast that I really listen to, which is called Thought Topics. It's these two young gay boys in Chicago.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm obsessed with them. They're so
THOT guys.
Yeah. They're so funny. Yeah. And watching, have I watched anything this week? I don't think I've, well, I guess it's just Tuesday, so there's time. Oh, Wednesday before I went, I go to the horse tracks every Wednesday in Pasadena. I mean, every Sunday in Pasadena. And before I went, I was watching Yellow Jackets.
That's supposed to be great.
Yeah, it's nice. I love a little horror. I love a little horror. And it has a horror element to it.
But you go to the horse tracks every Sunday?
Usually, yeah. It's the only time I was talking to my therapist about this yesterday. It's the only time that I'm actually like fully able to like dissociate from and like be present and stuff. I don't know what it is about it. It's like the only time that I'm not thinking about work is when I'm at the tracks and when I'm really not thinking about anything else besides betting on horses.
That's incredible.
It's weird.
That's amazing. That's very interesting.
Yeah.
I think that should be like our new question, because now I want to know what everyone's disassociating like tactic is, because it reminds me of a friend who's like a showrunner. Who's probably on strike right now. The only thing she can do is go to escape rooms
to
disassociate, because like she can't watch TV or movies because she's thinking about work.
Yeah.
She can't like read because then she's thinking about work.
Yeah.
So she goes to escape rooms. She's like goes all over town all the time.
Yeah. Cause like, even for me, like exercise doesn't really do that. You know, taking a walk doesn't do that, you know, any sort of way. Yeah. That other people dissociate doesn't really do that much for me. But yeah, the horse races do.
How do you disassociate, Alexis?
Fucking TikTok, man. Come on. Absolutely on TikTok. And besides, after that, it would probably be, if I'm trying to do something a little bit less like mind numbing, I would say, I don't know. I don't think I have one. And I think I need one. I need like an activity. It used to be Orange Theory before I broke up with Orange Theory, you know? That used to be my space, but can't do that anymore. What about you, Erica?
Cardio.
Yeah, you're a little.
Yeah. And or yoga.
It has to be hard. Oh God, no, I can never tune out in yoga. Carly, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs if they are so inclined?
So my Instagram is Carly Packer, Carlye, spelled weirdly, and then Packer. And I don't know, I can just Google?
Yeah, just Google her. I'm going to put all of that, guys, in the little blurby as per usual. And again, I'm Alexis, hide or die everywhere.
I'm Erica Wong at To Practice Practice.
Until next time, bye.
Bye.